I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The Great American Western celebrates its 100th birthday this fall. Kit Carson and the Great Train Robbery didn't have this kind of distinctive soundtrack when they played on the silver screen. The first Westerns were, of course, silent. In fact, any tour through the genealogy of the Western shows how many different progenitors the film actually has. B-Westerns, spaghetti Westerns, singing cowboys, and shoot-'em-up derbies. This hour, we'll look back over the history of the Western and examine its role in defining American morality and culture. So, Connection listeners, saddle up. What marks this medium for you? Is it the lonely hero, the endless horizons, or the black-and-white moral backdrop? Or is it the backseat given to women and Native Americans? Is there any one character, one film, one moment that you regard as quintessential? More to the point, does the Western still speak for America today? And is the spirit of the West making a comeback off-screen as well as on? With us on the program today, Holly George Warren. She writes extensively on Western film, music, and fashion. She's author of a book called Cowboy, How Hollywood Invented the Wild West. Holly, it's good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
And joining us also is Scott Simon. He is an English professor and co-director of the Film Studies Program at University of California, Davis. His new book is called The Invention of the Western Film, A Cultural History of the Genre's First Half Century. Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, both of you, I thought we'd start with what many of us revere about the classic Western. Let's just listen to a scene from High Noon. This is 1952, Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly.
I sent a man up 5 years ago for murder. He was supposed to hang. But up north, they commuted it to life. Now he's free. I don't know how. Anyway, it looks like he's coming back.
I still don't understand.
Well, he was always wild, kind of crazy. He'll probably make trouble.
But that's no concern of yours, not anymore.
I'm the one who sent him up.
Well, that was part of your job. That's finished now. They've got a new marshal.
Won't be here till tomorrow. Seems to me I've got to stay.
Oh, Will. Well, I'm begging you, please, let's go.
I can't.
Don't try to be a hero. You don't have to be a hero. Not for me.
I'm not trying to be a hero. If you think I like this, you're crazy. Look, Amy, this is my town. I've got friends here. I'll swear in a bunch of special deputies, and with a posse behind me, maybe there won't even be any trouble.
You know there'll be trouble.
Then it's better to have it here.
Well, Scott, that to me is sort of a 1 minute and 3 second encapsulation of everything that's
exactly
used to define morality in America.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a pretty classic moment. One of the things that almost always happens in Westerns is there's the moment when the woman suggests the possibility of a pacifist solution, and the man has to sort of shift awkwardly through the speech before letting her know that this is not the solution that the Western is going to come up with.
Special deputies. Those are the solution, Holly. Holly, are you...
Back at the earlier part of, you know, one of the early films and one of the first books to kind of propagate this idea into the culture that the filmmakers picked up on.
I want to go back a little bit, Scott, and I thought it would probably be useful just to use what you thought up as the title of your book, The Invention of the Western Film, because as we mark its 100th anniversary, you're making the case that really what even began as the Western film wasn't really a genuine reflection of what may have or might have been going on.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, one of the criticisms of Westerns, which is certainly valid, is that they're not very accurate about reflecting the truth of the West or of history. But, I mean, what I always think is that they're quite accurate about reflecting what's going on in America at the time the films were made. And in some ways, that makes them more interesting than their sort of bogus history.
As a matter of fact, there is a part of the High Noon film that speaks to that, and maybe we can get that ready. This, of course, again, 1952, and this is a trailer for the film. We should listen to this in context of what was going on with all the fears of communism at the time.
A terror-stricken town left him to face four killers, single-handed, at High Noon. With every swing of the pendulum, with every second, a man's life ticked away. Never have so few moments held such excitement.
Miller!
Was the sound of the guns frightened you that much?
Holly George Warren, should we or can we trace the Western by looking at what was going on in the history over the past 100 years, in the way that the films were made or the way that they were marketed?
Well, you can definitely see what was going on in the socio-political climate of the time. For High Noon, for example, it's been argued both sides of the coin, but the way I see it, Gary Cooper kind of stands for the guy who's been, you know, the screenwriter who's been accused of being a communist collaborator and being forced to, you know, squeal on his friends and name names, which was going on with McCarthy hearings at that time. And a lot of people did turn on each other and to save their careers and take the easy way out and, you know, name names so that they wouldn't be kind of lose their career by being considered a communist. On the other hand, people look at it the other way and say that, you know, he was a strong man standing up to the bad guys who represent communism.
And is there a point at which, Scott, you're putting too much on what's just a Western?
Well, I mean, to stay with High Noon for a minute, I mean, it's probably a political parable, but as Holly points out, it's such an ambiguous one. That is, Carl Foreman, the screenwriter, made no secret of writing it as an anti-McCarthyist tract. But a lot of people read it as a sort of pro-Korean War tract. That is, that America has to stand alone against the communists and none of the townsfolk, i.e. the allies, are coming to our aid. So, you know, it was easy, and it's true for a lot of Westerns, that they don't want to displease their audience, so that even when they're political, they can sometimes be pretty ambiguously political.
But then again, Howard Hawks, another great Western filmmaker, came along, and he kind of wanted to do an answer film to High Noon.
Yes.
And he did the film Rio Bravo, starring the unlikely cast of John Wayne with Ricky Nelson and Dean Martin. And in that one, the townspeople do stick up with, or at least some of them stick up with the John Wayne character, the older sheriff guy having to defend the town against the bad guys, to show that, you know, Americans do have, you know, this quality of sticking to their moral values and sticking together and not kind of running scared like the picture that was painted in High Noon.
Scott, let me ask you to just jump us ahead to in the 100-year history, to just prior to the Second World War, because at that point the Western kind of came back from its B status in the Depression era theaters to something that was bigger and grander and is seen in retrospect as something more patriotic. And I'm wondering, in your view, whether or not the patriotism or the morality that the films were demonstrating at that time were meant to lead American morals or just reflect what was going on in society?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, I think, because they always try to do both things at once. I mean, in terms of the history of the Western pretty much completely died during World War II. There were films like Cowboy Commandos, where the cowboys sing, "I'm going to get der Fuhrer sure as shootin'." the Western kind of lent its motifs to stories about, anti-Japanese, the Japanese kind of taking over for the Indians during the war. But after the war, it's true that maybe it's, even one thinks of it as kind of a classic era of the Westerns. And probably Westerns definitely get kind of darker and more interesting at that time.
Is that, Holly, in your view, because after the war, people couldn't be that excited about, you know, solving every solution on the screen with a shootout in the last scene?
Yeah, I think the horror that came out of the ending of the war and how much loss of life there was, and also just even the returning GIs coming back with shell shock and, you know, post-traumatic stress. I mean, a lot of these were the same people who had been you know, loving the shoot 'em up cowboy movies, but the last thing they wanted to hear was that kind of thing, and to see the, because they knew there was no clear cut good versus evil answer. So you get a lot more of the, you know, kind of Anthony Mann style, very ambiguous, you know, brother versus brother, very kind, much more brutal type westerns, and even the most frivolous type of westerns you can think of, like the Gene Autry and the Roy Rogers musical westerns, even had more violence in them. They didn't dress up, you know, in the fancy outfits as they had before the war. They were just kind of a more sober type cowboy, and some of the actors, you know, had served in the war. So that, I mean, Gene Autry himself was a cargo pilot and flew missions over Burma. So he had actually, you know, seen the frightening experience of real life, you know, good versus evil. So I think it really affected his approach to filmmaking.
And I know that I might be jumping around a little bit here, but if we move to the mid-60s at a point when the Western, the violence in Western became more and more a part of the images that they were showing, that whole idea of good versus evil was breaking down. This is a scene from the beginning of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, when Clint Eastwood, who's the so-called good, is in the middle of the desert with his fellow con man.
You never had a rope around your neck. Well, I'm going to tell you something. When that rope starts to pull tight, you can feel the devil bite your ass.
Yeah, you're right. It's getting tougher. The way I figure, there's really not too much future with a sawed-off front like you.
What do you mean?
Because I don't think you'll ever be worth more than $3,000.
What do you mean?
I mean, our partnership is untied. Oh, no.
Wait.
Not you. You remain tied. I'll keep the money and you can have the rope.
You filthy double-crossing bastard of all the stinking dirty tricks.
Way back to town is only 70 miles. Now, if you save your breath, I feel a man like you could manage it. Adios.
You filthy bastard! Come here! Come here! Cut this rope off! Get off that horse! Get off that horse! You filthy cunt!
Such ingratitude after all the times I've saved your life.
Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Is there a moment that marks the Western in your mind? Where do you see the morality tangled up with films like that one? Scott, The Good and Bad and the Ugly, is that a beginning of the end of the Western because those lines started to get blurred?
That's a really wonderful, memorable moment. And, you know, The Good and Bad and the Ugly is one of those films that still survives. I mean, one of the things about Westerns is it couldn't be a more unpopular genre now. I hope that sound I hear isn't people clicking their radios off as we discuss this. But The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly does hold up and still have a lot of viewers. And one of the things about it, which you can see even in the title, is that it's beyond good and evil, and that there's a kind of, you know, Machiavellian moral relativism going on, that the guy we like best, Clint Eastwood, is only slightly less pitiless than the guy we like least, and you end with this boring shootout of three people. These films were made in Italy, and have a lot of influence.
You don't really care at that point who dies. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, talk about the Western. We're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Western film on this program. And we're wondering where you marked that genre. Was there a point at which, clutching a nickel, you lined up at the Capitol Theater for something that you just couldn't miss? Or do you have to run screaming from the room when the late-night cable of Westerns come on? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public Radio.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon, and we're talking about the Western. 1-800-423-8255. Where it fits in the American psyche, if it even fits today, or as the simplistic or nostalgic message of films that were made in the 40s and the 50s, now so far beyond us that we only see little echoes of that in Lucasfilm's Space Wars type movies. And I think maybe, Holly George Warren, before we completely walk away from how this all started, if we go back to the beginning of the 1900s and what was being shown at that time, Were they films about character? Were they films about landscape? What was it that people wanted to try and capture with the original Westerns?
Well, I think they wanted to capture a vanishing lifestyle in the beginning. I mean, when the great train robbery was made, there were still a few train robberies actually going on, but as far as the trail drives and that aspect of the West, that was pretty much had been over for, you know, a couple of decades. And they were originally made back east. Some of them were made in New Jersey, right outside of New York City. That's where the great train robbery was. And it was basically characters kind of based on characters from dime novels and exaggerated figures as had been presented in the Wild West shows. And that just made the transition to the moving pictures, and it went from there.
Scott, there's a story you tell in the start of your book, The Invention of the Western Film, about Kit Carson, which I think kind of well illustrates that.
Well, yes. Sometimes it's hard to tell where the truth of the Western and the fiction of the West divide. And the story that I tell at the beginning of the book is that Kit Carson, this is in 1849, before the Civil War, was searching for a woman who had been abducted by the Apache, tracking her through New Mexico, very wild. And when he came to the camp, the abandoned camp, he found a book in the trash there. And it turned out to be a novel about the scouting exploits of Kit Carson. And he was always worried. He mentions it in his autobiography that this woman was given hope. She was actually found dead. She was given hope by reading this novel in which, as Kit Carson says, "I was made a great hero, killing Indians by the hundred."
So Holly, was the whole thing built on a myth, on an idea of what the West was like rather than what happened?
Pretty much. I mean, once in a while, there are elements of truth that come in. And, of course, when we get up to recent Western films, the revisionist films, you see much more of an accurate picture. But back in the day, when they were actually filmed out west, even, and real cowhands started, you know, going out to be extras, or real cowboys who rode in the Wild West shows wanted to be in the films, sometimes they would show up and the directors would say, "You don't look enough like a cowboy. You have to, you know, get gussied up a little bit more to look the way we think a cowboy should look." In fact, even, you know, real bank robbers and, you know, bad guys who had actually robbed trains sometimes were told to dress up a little more to look a little more frightening and the way a bad guy should when they got out of prison and ended up being extras in these films. So it definitely, at least as far as the look and the simplistic depiction of the action and the way that it was mostly all white guys, when in reality, I think 1/3 of all the cowboys that took place, you know, that took part in the trail drives were either black or Hispanic. So those kind of pictures were very much exaggerated and changed.
All right. Speaking of simplistic depictions, let's hear a short clip from the film Dakota. And I want you to pay particular attention in this 1945 black and white Western to the woman. And the man you'll hear is John Wayne.
"I hope you'll excuse me for not getting up, but we've had a fire, as you can see, in my... Well, I got burned a little trying to save a few things. Donka, haven't we something for our visitors to sit on?"
"No got."
"Well, I'm sorry. It doesn't seem we've got very much left. Poor Anson. That's Mr. Stowe. He worked so hard. And they came and raided and burned the place the night he left. Oh, but you must be very tired and hungry."
"Oh, no, we've just come a couple of miles. We wondered if we could borrow some horses."
"Well, there are four of you. You may have four, of course."
"Well, thank you very much. We'll return them as soon as we can. But I think if you're able to travel, you should go with us to Fargo."
"No, I'll be all right here until Anson gets back."
"I'll be all right here." 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call here from Westboro, Massachusetts. Scott's joining us. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, if I could, that in my view, I know quite a bit about the West, not much about films, but quite a bit about the West. Westerns aren't just the simple-minded, anti-intellectual, sexist, wartime propaganda films. The extremely thin law enforcement out there made the West I think, sort of like Afghanistan, people could do whatever they want, and people were on their own, and there just are so many remarkable stories of survival and horrific torture and just all kinds of outrageous acts.
We're not talking about actually what necessarily happened in the West, Scott, as much as we're talking about the way that Hollywood chose to portray that and whether or not it simplified what you're describing.
I think that environment creates a canvas for the artist to portray human character that's, you know, fairly unique. And then from that have come the films we see. And, yeah, the connection to reality is often not true, and there are many fascinating, I think, colorful facts that are true that are portrayed. And if I could, I would like to make one brief point. I think the Indians were actually, there was horrific torture and so on, and they engaged in terrorism, and were, you know, much like the Palestinians today. They're not bad people. It's just what they did, and they were exploited by greater powers like the French and so on. And that story in itself, the West is fascinating. There are so many stories. And
it's interesting, Scott. I want to pick up on your reference to Indians there, because the way that the Native American Indian is portrayed kind of prescribes something of an arc, Scott. There is a period of time, I think more in the silent films, when they're just portrayed as mindless savages. But then that changes.
Right. The other Scott's defense of the Western, I think, is worthwhile, because there are, you know, the films are not necessarily entirely simple. And as you mentioned, particularly in the silent period, which is what I write about partly in the book, the Western, the Indians were very prominent, often the heroes of the films. There was a Native American director, for instance, James Young Deere, who directed a Winnebago Indian, who directed about 100 films for Pathé. And the stories often made Indians, Native Americans, more heroic than they would be for the next 50 years of the genre.
And just reflecting back, Holly, on that clip from Dakota, I guess what I find charming about it, I mean, whoever the screenwriter wrote the line for the Native American helper who said, "No got," should be shot. But there's a kind of campiness about it when we listen to it now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just, you know, it's pretty much the same sort of stereotypes of women, of the Native American characters, the few black characters that are in the films that were in other types of films at the same time, be them, you know, the big musicals, mm-hmm. the other drama vehicles, kind of carried through with the Westerns. And a few women did start kind of taking on the stronger roles. Of course, Barbara Stanwyck is one of the major ones, and showing, you know, that there were very strong women, and women were in a minority who did go out west and did go on trail drives, but there definitely were some women, and they really were role models for, I think, the women of today as far as being very independent and working right alongside the men, and the same thing with the rodeos and all that kind of thing. And, you know, gradually, again, with the revisionist Westerns in the 90s, we've seen more of these type of women portrayed in the films.
1-800-423-8255 to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Phillip's calling in. Hi, Philip.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Have you got a favorite?
I have one of my recent favorites. I really like the Red River movie with The Searchers. I'm a film student or a film buff, and The Searchers was just a gorgeous photographic film.
It's a John Ford, isn't it?
Right. It was a John Ford Western, and John Wayne starred in it. And that's one of my all-time favorites, but my latest favorite, or one I rank very highly, is The Unforgiven that Clint Eastwood starred in and directed.
And that wasn't so long ago, was it, Philip?
It wasn't very long ago. I think it was 92 or not. It was in the early 90s. He got the Academy Award for Direction.
Right.
And just the lines and the plot of, a man alone on the prairie by necessity goes off to bounty hunt some cattlemen or some ranch hands because they cut a prostitute in a fight, in a bar fight. And the whole existence question was examined, and some myths exploded as well. There's one of my favorite line from the film is Clint Eastwood is under a tree and he's waiting for this woman to bring them the money for what they've done. They've killed the ranch hands, and he's sitting there with his partner, and his partner has killed for the first time. And he says, you know, you just can't give a man back his life. You're taking away everything you ever had. And Clint Eastwood replies to it, well, that's true. That's, you know, it's, you know, he says, I guess he had it coming. And Clint Eastwood said, we've all got it coming. So that was one of the lines. I kind of mangled it a little bit. But the film is worth looking at for photography and also for what it talks about.
But interesting also that it takes some of the themes, some of the original themes, and makes them relevant in the years after the Western was thought to have sort of peaked and then died.
Yeah, because just the performances, Gene Hackman gives a wonderful performance. They touch on the mythologizing, where there's a writer who plays a big part in it, who writes dime novels and basically lies about, you know, what happens in gunfights and things like that. There's Richard Harris has a great role. It's a very good film. There's a black actor in it as well, who does a very good job.
When I was reading for the program today, it was one of the ones that was actually recommended by one of the reviewers. Scott Simon, a favorite of yours, Unforgiven?
Oh, yes, I'm quite fond of Unforgiven. I mean, these days, Westerns come out so infrequently that it's always good to see
for those
a good
who
one.
Like them, yeah. Oh. But
one of the things, I mean, one of the things that both of the callers have suggested in kind of defenses of the Westerns is, you know, that at their best, they talk about essential things. I mean, what makes life worth living? What makes justice in the world? And I think, you know, films that can do that and kind of get to the core, you have to really appreciate. And it's true that sometimes they're burdened down by their representations mm-hmm. of minority groups and women. And but they can do something kind of essential also.
Philip mentioned the film The Searchers, John Ford film. And I wanted to ask both of you something that surprised me. I was poking around in the internet and looking through a search engine with Ford's name, and was surprised to see the number of foreign language websites popping up. And it reminded me that, you know, the Western doesn't just stand as an example for Americans of what was or which people wished was American, but it's seen very much by people outside this country as what America is or stood for. Holly, is that your experience?
Oh, that's definitely true. I mean, whenever anyone in another country sees someone with a cowboy hat and a pair of cowboy boots, they immediately think, you know, John Wayne, the Western American. And the films are always very, very popular overseas, too. I mean, you were talking before about the Leone films. You know, here you have an Italian director. He was shooting the films in Spain using Italian, German, and American actors. And, in fact, one way he got his money to get going with the films was because at that time there was a very popular Western series on German TV. So the interest in Europe for Westerns was very great, and even in Japan. Some of the great Westerns were influenced by Japanese film, which were in turn, you know, influenced by American films. So it's definitely a kind of one of those archetypal, universal, symbolic elements, but still says America overseas.
I remember when I was living in Russia, the one character that everybody knew was the Marlboro Man. It wasn't because of the cigarettes. It was because of the cowboy hat. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky now. Larry's joining us. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. Go ahead.
I was just wanting to make a comment. I'm 46, so I grew up with John Wayne and Audie Murphy and Gene Autry and Gary Cooper and those guys. And, you know, I'm still a big fan of Westerns, so one thing that I recall in my younger days is, you know, I always had this image of cowboys, even the bad guys, still being somewhat chivalrous, you know, and respecting the ladies. And I recall, and I don't remember the name of the film, but there was a scene in the film where, and of course films back then weren't near as graphic as they are now, but obviously this young woman had been raped, and she said something to her father, and I'll never forget the line. He said, well, out here, a man picks his pleasure from the nearest tree. And, you know, I'm wondering then, because that kind of floored me, and I was like, wait a minute, cowboys don't, that's not something that a cowboy dad would say to his daughter. And so, but I'll never forget that. And it's kind of like, you know, when did the moral breakdown start to where it was like, well, that's okay.
Let's see if either Holly or Scott can fill us in. Do either of you know the film that Larry's describing?
You've stumped the stars.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Do you remember who was in the film?
No, I can't. It's been so long ago. It was probably in the late 60s, early 70s.
Was it one where the woman ends up taking revenge against the guy that raped her in later life? Because there were some films like that in the 70s.
It may have been, but it was just that one line because it kind of, like I said, always having this image of
right.
the rough, tough guys out west that all had respect, you know, ma'am, everybody was ma'am.
I would say definitely in the 60s, overseas with the Leone films, where anyone was fair game, you know, for raping and pillaging and torture. I mean, women and children were sometimes shot down in cold blood first, things like that you would never, ever see in an earlier Western film. But in America, the same thing was happening with Sam Peckinpah films. Even early on, 1962, Ride the Wild Country, it showed, you know, things like just kind of an immoral group of, you know, cowboys who just wanted exactly to do that, to rape and pillage, and then they got more and more, you know, brutal as Peckinpah films went on with The Wild Bunch, and show that even young children, I think the film opens with these giant red ants, you know, destroying a scorpion, and these young children laughing and watching and goading on this kind of torturous insect thing, showing how even the young children weren't innocent. They were just as bloodthirsty as the killers who would shoot, you know, just these scenes of carnage with preachers getting shot down and women and children getting run over in the streets and these kind of things.
Larry, so, quick last question to you. Do you still like Westerns?
Oh, I still love Westerns, and I think America loves Westerns. If you look at the popularity of the miniseries Lonesome Dove and you see what's happening at the theaters right now with the new Kevin Costner film, I think Americans like Westerns, and so I sure do. My wife and I both love them. So
thank you for calling. Nice to have you on the program. Connection listeners, does the Western or did the Western represent America? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support for National Public
Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Is the Western making a comeback on screen or off the screen? Holly George Warren is with us. She's author of a new book called Cowboy, How Hollywood Invented the Wild West. Scott Simon, professor of English and co-director of the Film Studies Program at UC Davis, is with us. He's also author of a new book called The Invention of the Western Film, A Cultural History of the Genre's First Half Century. And just before the break, we were talking with Larry from Louisville, who was mentioning the latest Western to come to the big screen. It's a Kevin Costner film called Open Range. And here's how they're marketing it.
Beautiful country. Man can get lost out here. Forget there's people and things that ain't so simple as this.
I always hoped somebody gentle and caring might come along.
I'm not who you think I am, Sue.
Most time a man will tell you his bad intentions if you listen, let yourself hear.
You reckon them cows worth getting killed over?
Cows is one thing, but one man telling another man where he can go in this country is something else.
I got no problem with killing boss. Never have.
1-800-423-8255. Scott Simon, it's so similar to the same tone and the sound of the very first piece of tape that we listened to from High Noon. I wanted to hear first you and then Holly just talk about whether or not these films succeed simply because they remind us of what was, or whether or not the Western is, you know, finding some kind of new place in the theaters.
Well, that's right. I mean, Open Range is quite a heartening film. I mean, it's quite good with a couple qualifications we can talk about. But it's very much a kind of purely classical American film. We've talked about some of these Italian spaghetti westerns, and they were more the model for the few westerns that have been made in the last decade. Gene Hackman in The Quick and the Dead, or a film called South of Heaven, West of Hell. But Open Range is very much kind of traditional classic Western. And, you know, at its best, it tries to talk about what Robert Duvall was talking about there about justice and what makes for justice.
But, okay, Holly, let's hear from you first.
Yeah, I think that there is a chance, too, that there are going to be more films like The Open Range when Hollywood sees that there is a growing audience for these type of films. I think my theory is that there was kind of a whole generation, people maybe in their late 20s now, who kind of missed out on being imprinted by Westerns as kids, like the way I was and the guy from Louisville and Scott. I mean, we grew up watching these, so we've always kind of wanted to go and check them out, whereas kids growing up, you know, in the 70s and the 80s had nothing like this to see. And now with the cable channels bringing Westerns back in such a big way, with a whole channel, the Westerns Channel, with Hallmark doing new Western film, you know, new miniseries, TNT, I think, did this Tom Selleck film, Monty Walsh, that I think had 7.5 million viewers tuning in, which was like a huge breaking, you know, record. So I think as people become exposed to these films and filmmakers see that there's an audience, we'll get some more high-quality, good Western films again. I think there's quite a few in production actually right now. I believe I've heard that Tommy Lee Jones is doing a new one that's supposed to be really good. And
Ron Howard's got one in, mm-hmm. in production.
Yes, that's actually the same film.
Oh, is it?
Called The Missing.
Okay.
But it is interesting, having seen the preview for The Missing at my local theater last week, how much the preview itself tries to disguise the fact that it is a Western. I think, you know, Westerns are considered not particularly saleable, so that even though a few Westerns are being made, they're generally sort of not promoted as Westerns.
All right.
But we have to keep in mind that that kind of attitude has happened before. I mean, even back in the late 30s, they had really, the big budget Westerns had really, really died out after a few big flops. And then, you know, with Stagecoach, you know, bringing it back, they came back again. So but again, it was kind of like disguised when they first came back. So
it's true. It's, I mean, how many times has the musical been pronounced dead? And look what mm-hmm. Chicago did this year. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Canton, New York. Clark, you're with us. Hi.
Hi, yes, hi.
Are you a fan?
Oh, yes. I have to say, from the first day I saw The Good and the Bad and the Ugly on Turner Classic Movies, it completely blew me away.
How old are you, Clark?
I'm 21.
And do you go out of your way to watch them, or are you one of these late-night cable hounds?
Oh, no, I guess I'm a DVD junkie, so I go out of my way to find the ones I want.
Do you think the Western is or could or might be coming back?
Well, I'd like to see a return to the old auteur theory of directing, where, you know, we get some new John Hustons or John Fords or Sergio Leones and start, you know, releasing some, I don't know, some creative Western movies and not all this cookie-cutter stuff that's out there.
But do you think the appetite's there for that, Clark?
I think so. I think we're at the right time period for it.
Why?
I think
why?
Just what's going on in the world right now. It's I don't know, Westerns don't sugarcoat things, and we've been taking a lot of, I don't know, sugar-coated movies, and I think we need some raw, gritty stories, too.
It's funny, because you talk about the non-sugar-coated, raw, gritty stories, and some people are talking about the Western as, you know, a way of simplifying the world where there aren't terrorists under every rock, but there's one good guy in a white hat and one bad guy in a black hat.
Ah, yeah, I suppose. But my favorite Western film, which you already talked about, is The Wild Bunch, and there is no one good guy or one bad guy in that.
They're all.
Yeah. Because
one of the things I would say about that, though, and it is what's a little bit maybe problematic about Westerns, is that The Wild Bunch shares it with Open Range, is that Westerns almost invariably end with a shootout. That is, it's almost, you know, the thousands of Westerns being made, it's hard to think of any that don't conclude with a shootout. And that's kind of the story the Western tells, which is that you, if you look at Open Range, for instance, you have this despot who has too much power and too much land, and, you know, the American good guys have to do something about this despot, and ultimately they have to take out their guns and have a shootout. And for the Western, that's the end of the story, as opposed to, you know, what we're seeing outside in the world now, mm-hmm. which is that after you have a shootout, there's also problems that you have to deal with. And the Western is completely unequipped to talk about that.
Although
and,
it does give us the comfort the comfort of an ending.
It does. I mean, it tells you a fable. But it does simplify the... Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to Beaufort County, South Carolina. Steve's joining us now. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I am very interested in the topic of conversation today. I, some years ago, developed... I was born Mennonite, a pacifist in a pacifist community in Pennsylvania. And I developed a strange fascination with Sam Peckinpah. And
I can't imagine you seeing a lot of those films in the Mennonite community on a Saturday night.
No, I don't know quite how I came up on them. I think Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid was the first one I saw, and I was completely enamored with it. I'm also a young writer. I've written one novel. And I sort of write, you might say, in the realist genre. And I'm interested, I mean, your question earlier about whether Westerns, at least in the first part of this century, are representative of America or how America was. And, mm-hmm. and one would have to say, or at least I would have to say, certainly no. And this was Peckinpah's great contribution.
You think The Wild Bunch is more representative, or The Battle of Cable Hog, that sort of film?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one thinks about, well, the image that she's talked about earlier, the scorpions, the ants, that, you know, another image comes to mind is the children playing on the gallows and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid swinging on the rope, giggling. You know, this stuff, it's much darker than what we would like to remember or believe.
So, why is it kind of fallen from favor or fashion, Steve?
Well, it's not... It's not as much fun to not feel good, you know, and it's not as popular to see, you know, the two guys who were formerly best friends, you know, in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, the way in Peckinpah's version, here comes Bruce Coburn at the end, killing Kris Kristofferson, killing Billy the Kid. And, you know, they were formerly riding mates, and now he went over to work for the ranchers. And, you know, I actually got so fascinated with Peckinpah, I ended up buying his old apartment in an old hotel out in Montana.
No buckshot in the walls there, is there, Steve?
There is. There are bullet holes that we have unearthed.
Wow. How many bottles of booze have you found hidden away?
Well, we found strange things. We found some strange things, but...
Now,
yeah,
Steve, don't get too far down the rabbit hole here. It's just movies, okay? Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you very much.
All right. Holly, just I know that you've spent time, you do spend time, going to gatherings where people, you know, put on Western gear and talk about films. And I just wanted you to contrast that to Steve's sense of the kind of gritty and uncomfortable side of the Western to what people that you meet and talk to like and revere about either the old or the classic Western?
Most of these, in fact, I just came back from one. There was actually two last weekend in little towns in Oklahoma and Texas celebrating Gene Autry's birthday. So it was more of a kind of singing cowboy film and music festival. But most of the people do tend to dress up as the heroic characters. You don't see too many bad guys. You do see some of the funny sidekicks, the smiley brunettes and the Rube types, and you see lots of Dale Evans and Annie Oakley, the TV Annie Oakley, which was a sharp-shooting cowgirl rather than the girl from Ohio from the Wild West shows. But most of the people tend to be very patriotic and very, religious people, and they see these films as standing for a very pure ethical America that is always right, and they definitely prefer, I think, the pre 1960s kind of murky dark films. Now, on the other hand, we have the darker murky films influencing a whole other realm of people, like the people like Quentin Tarantino, the people like Robert Rodriguez, some of the new filmmakers, and some of the actors too, unfortunately not very good, but the West of Heaven, South of Hell or whatever, the Dwight Yoakam film, that was kind of an homage to Peckinpah, and people like Billy Bob Thornton. So we see, the darker ones, I think, kind of being much more influential on a younger, kind of more avant-garde, artier type crowd.
Scott, tell me whether or not the Western is coming back or making just a little blip with Open Range and The Missing, and other words. So you must be struck as a student, though, how much the film is reflected in American culture, either in the way that a president speaks or in the way that we define morals in this country.
Well, the Western is making a slight comeback. I mean, if you look at the 1930s, there were probably 1,000 Westerns made. In the 1990s, I would guess there were maybe 15 released in theaters. So the fact that now you can see 4 or 5 on the horizon looks like quite a renaissance, relatively speaking.
But it's more like the spirit of the West is very much still with us, though, no?
Well, it's true. I think, political figures have always tried to tie themselves into the spirit of the West, from Andrew Jackson trying to connect himself to Daniel Boone, to Teddy Roosevelt telling his stories about the West, to Ronald Reagan and his ranch. So that I think maybe that's not so new, that it's a kind of long tradition that you see coming back again.
Scott, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Simon, professor of English and co-director of the Film Studies program at UC Davis. And Holly George Warren, nice to have you with us.
Oh, I really enjoyed this conversation. I wonder why no women called in, though.
They're listening. Holly's author of Cowboy, How Hollywood Invented the Wild West. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Hey, you get back here, you pass. Can I say to winter? In no way that nobody's going to leave this town. Hell, I was born here, and I was raised here, and dadgummit, I'm gonna die here. And no sidewinding, bushwhacking, horn swoggling, crocker crocker is gonna roll away. This is gutter.
Now, who can argue with that?
Rabbit!
Not only was it authentic frontier gibberish, it expressed a courage little seen in this day and age. What are we made of? Our fathers came across the prairie, fought Indians, fought drought, fought locusts, fought Dix. Remember when Richard Dix came in here and tried to take over this town? But we didn't give up then. And by gum, we're not gonna give up now.
Rabbit.
Rabbit.